Good evening. So the way I figured I would do this is give kind of an introductory overview of the issues, and then we can just have a conversation around the case. Feel free to interrupt at any point. I don't usually want to lecture, but I think this is the easiest way to kind of get through and make sure everybody's on the same page. So we're going to talk about the ethics of science to start. The first thing I want to talk about is, what is ethics? Some masters of bioethics students here, some people with philosophical backgrounds. So what is it? What is ethics? I put the answer. You can converse about it, or you can look up there. But seriously, what do you think of it? Somebody says something about ethics. What do you think?
Yeah. Generally, I think of ethics as kind of like an outline for our moral duties and obligations.
Could be. I mean, in some ways, what you're talking about is the framework. It's an approach to kind of like deciding what's moral and not. Mm-hmm. And that's probably a good frame for it. So what I've kind of thrown up one definition, and it's like the ethics is kind of like it's a meta-analytic approach of deciding what, and separating the good from the bad, deciding what's good. And this is in contraposition to morals, which these terms are often used interchangeably. But morals really are, I think, most usefully thought of as shared values or value systems. So the Ten Commandments, right, it's a moral code. It lays out duties, thou shalt, shalls, and shall nots. And it's shared by those people who ascribe to it. And you could also go back beyond that and just say the Golden Rule is a moral code. I mean, if you want to, it was the Golden Rule: do unto others as you would want to have done to you, or something, some version of that. And that, by itself, is just kind of a set of, it's a moral, it's moral. It makes things, and actually, it's a rule that helps you decide what's moral or not. Unlike the Ten Commandments, which is actually prescriptions of various acts. Anyway, these terms, like I said, these terms are used interchangeably. And when we get to science, ethics and science and the professions are really assertions of what are good or bad in those fields, right? So in law or in medicine, you've got people who kind of like decided that there are various things that are good to do and bad to do. Sometimes it's not universal. I mean, and sometimes the people who are making the rules aren't necessarily serving the interests, or you have to question what interests they're serving. The early codes in law and in medicine, back in the 1800s, basically served the interest of the profession, right? And you know, they kind of preserved the prerogatives of the profession very much. In law, for instance, I think the idea that you can't, in fact, it was in medicine as well, is you're protecting other doctors in the practice of medicine. I mean, doctors, one of the things in the medical code was it was the regular doctors trying to get rid of the irregulars, the abortionists and others who didn't practice and hadn't gone to the schools at all. In law, it was really, what was your relationship as a practicing lawyer with other lawyers, if I remember correctly. So, do you remember that from many years ago? And over time, I think that's changed, especially in medicine. You know, we've got the more recent codes, like the American Medical Association, I think they've gotten rid of. If you look at the code of 1847, it is really different in kind than the most recent code. And the code actually came of age in the 60s, and it recognizes the rights of patients, and is more serving the public interest of the profession. So how do we decide if something is good or bad? Here's a guy, he's down, he's tackled by a Florida player, and he's untying his opponent's shoe. It's the latest strategy, sweeping the SEC. So, is this okay? And who decides?
It's going to harm
him. I'm sorry?
If it's going to harm the player, yeah.
I mean, it does risk that, right?
Yeah, there's a risk.
I think it's taken from the point of view of the society, and from the point of view who the person who is suffering the condition of. Because if I'm suffering the condition, so I can reject something, and from the point of view of society, they judge if something is good or it's bad. Even they don't know too much about what we can know about it.
Okay, so we're society. How do we go about deciding? I mean, is it just a kind of a gut feeling that we shouldn't really let this? I mean, on the other hand, you know, it's like winner take all. I mean, you have certain moral codes that basically would reward this kind of innovative thinking. It's like, you know, this guy trips and the next play you score a touchdown and the ref didn't see it and the guy didn't see it. I mean, you know, it just happened, right? His shoe came undone. Oops. I remember when I was playing soccer in graduate school and this guy from the Navy. So it was getting dark and there was one ref way across the field and the guy from the other team kicked the ball out of bounds. He runs over, grabs the ball, puts it over his head like he's gonna throw it in. And I'm like, come on. The funny thing was he was a Navy ROTC undergrad. And I was like, and he was like looking to the ref for the call, and it's getting dark, and it's like, where's your code? You know, it's like, that's not okay. You know, even if the ref called for you, it's not okay to cheat. Now, that is cheating. And this is cheating. But what do we do about it? And who decides? Because there are different different kind of competing interests here. I mean, there's the risk of injury, and there is this idea that it's all kind of justified the ends just kind of justify the means, and that cheating does take place. Yeah.
I think it depends on the context. So if we're talking about a sport here, and in general, people would want to win a sport based on who is more skilled. So, you know, who's better at football, who's better at tying a shoe. Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, I would think. And here you'd say that you want something that where the attributes you're trying to foster, which is like the best skilled athlete or best skilled team wins.
Mm-hmm.
So in this case, I'd say that would kind of be the criteria that I try to use.
Mm-hmm. Anybody else? Yeah.
Yeah, I was thinking, in each community, there is principles and rules which govern the community.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them just occur subconsciously that, you know, this is right, this is wrong. You can say it's like something you have learned through experiencing. Then you know this is right, this is wrong, depending on the community. It's taking example that there that the ground, people are in the sport, but also in the sport that is another community. There are principles, there are rules which govern that one. So if you go within the rules, then you are right. But if you go outside, they say you are wrong.
Mm-hmm. But there may be no rule. Okay.
Look like that person is just pulling the what they want to open the what
the shoelace.
The shoes. Mm-hmm. So. I don't know. I don't think that the one is right. That is wrong.
Yeah, but there's probably no rule against that.
But if in the rule it's being allowed, I think it's ethical right mm-hmm. to do that. You know.
So why is it though? And why is our? I mean, our reaction in some sense. I mean, one reaction is that this is really bad, right? Because probably because of the risk of harm to the other player, mm-hmm. and because it's kind of cheating. I mean, they're supposed to kind of compete head to head, and you know, who better person wins. And this is not doing that. This is kind of like kind of doing something underhanded to kind of get an unfair advantage of the other person. On the other hand, in sports, it's like whatever it takes.
It's also interesting how you are asking how we deal with this, right? When someone is not acting good, and how is that now the sport has adapted to that? What is the solution? They put more referees. Or now the referee can go back and see on the TV what happened. When he is not clear, there is a fault.
And the guy falls with
it. That's also happening right now also in soccer when it used to be 3 or 4 referees. Now we have a third referee in the Europe League, right? They bring more referees to see who is cheating and who is not cheating. So it's like they're not trying to encourage the players to play, you know,
dirty.
The famous fair play. I mean, it's like the solution is put more referees, so these things don't happen.
Yeah, but why is that such a good solution, though? I mean, in some sense, we'll revisit this, but it's this issue that's, well, we can't trust these people to kind of like self-regulate and to do it correctly, so we have to add more police. It's like more institutional review boards. But, yeah.
It's just harmful to the game because it really, it's someone sabotaging basically the integrity of the game in this instance. And so even though there's no rule, it's just overall, if you want to say it's just bad sportsmanship, then, you know, maybe that is kind of an unwritten rule.
Is that, I don't know if that's actually a kind of a football rule, something that can profess. You first.
Speaking about law and rules, mm-hmm. I have the sense that not everything that is within law mm-hmm. is just.
Sure.
It's fair. Mm-hmm. Not everything.
Right. Yeah, we'll revisit that as well. That's a good point.
It's interesting when you ask the question of, you know, who decides. I mean, or I guess there's no rule directly addressing the idea of untying an opponent's shoes, but there is an unsportsmanlike conduct rule in football, and I think that a lot of times, whether it be in law or in sports, whatever, there's a general catch-all for just what we intuitively feel is not right. And obviously, then that begs the question of, like, who has determined what falls within that category?
And is it fairly applied?
Right, because once you enter that degree of subjectivity into it, then it's each individual's determination of what is right or wrong. Once you have a catch-all category like that, and I don't know how you ever get away from that, because you can never write a rule to anticipate a man untying another man's shoes. So I don't know.
Especially if, and I think it gets back to the kind of, does this community decide? Because if they're really that motivated by competition, it's like, well, sure, I would have probably done the same thing. So do you want them writing the rules? Okay, I spent enough time on this one. All right. So there are various approaches to kind of like deciding what's ethical or not. Right? One is a normative or prescriptive approach, kind of deciding what ought to be done under certain circumstances. And one is descriptive, so what is it that people actually do? And these are kind of like two different approaches, and sometimes you might do both. There are various methods of making decisions about ethics. There's deontology, which is a duty or rule-based kind of morality. Consequentialism, this is examination of potential outcomes, and it's a variant of utilitarianism. And then there's casuistry, which is a kind of a thick analysis, where you kind of a thick case analysis, where you kind of like look at all aspects and then play with the facts to see what facts are most critical to your decision. Okay, and you can do any of these in kind of like looking at the ethics of a situation. Kid says, "How am I supposed to think about consequences before they happen?" And consequentialism and utilitarianism are very difficult things to kind of anticipate what's going to happen. But as an analytic approach, they're good for decision making, but they are fraught with problems. Okay, so now we get to the issue of who decides. And I'm going to focus here on science, and I guess here on in. So science is, in some sense, a community. I mean, if you ask people who are scientists, they claim that they're scientists. That said, it's a community of people who are skilled in practice methods accepted by others, at least a reasonable minority of others, right? As assessed by their mentors and peer reviewers. Right? I mean, one of the things about science is it is extremely, I don't want to say risk averse, it's fairly pretty conservative in the sense that when you're doing science, you're going to be constrained by methods that are accepted by your peers. And you have to kind of like, to get your science published and to get a reputation amongst your peers, you have to do things that they accept as to be valid and to generate valid knowledge. Right? So in that sense, you can't be too far afield and be accepted. Scientific community may be defined, especially by methods, may be defined very narrowly. There are people who do qualitative methods, you know, kind of observational research and interviews and kind of talk to people. And then there are quantitative people who kind of look at big data sets. And sometimes, I mean, people have a tendency to deride, especially quantitative people, deride qualitative people. And then economists get derided by everybody. But so the field can be fairly, the field of your specialists, the people who are your peers, may be fairly narrow. In fact, in some of the physics review letters, I think, some of the journals, it's literally a handful of people worldwide who read these papers. In fact, some of the journals have gone to purely online, no peer review, online publication and dissemination among the peers, and they all kind of like peer review online, right? Because it's like such a small community that they're speaking to, that each of those people is skilled at reviewing the work, and they're all going to read each other's work anyway, so it works in that very small community. Of course, that doesn't work in medicine, right? You have tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people publishing and trying to generate knowledge, and other people disseminating it across the world using that knowledge. Codes of ethics, which are kind of statements of trying to anticipate problems, common problems in a field, are or have been promulgated by scientific societies. We see them in medicine and law. In medicine, you get various codes. So the American College of Surgeons had its own code. The American Medical Association had a code. The ACP, American College of Physicians, has its own code. And the ACP code will differ from the AMA code in some ways. In law, I guess there's the state Supreme Courts, which regulate law, often adopt their own codes of ethics. I don't know if they vary very much. I just never studied it. But they've also been adopted by other societies, like in engineering. There's various engineering societies have codes. In the social sciences, the American Sociological Association, the American Anthropological Association, the American Psychological Association all have their own codes of ethics about how do you conduct research within acceptable, or conduct yourself within those disciplines. And it turns out that within science, there's no true hierarchy of power or authority within the profession, within the community. That's kind of unlike other professions. I mean, even the American Medical Association has no real authority, but the states do, right? The states regulate physicians, the states regulate lawyers. So to the extent that, probably law is a more hierarchical relationship because the Supreme Court of each state, or its equivalent, regulates the practice of law in that state. In medicine, you get a license from the state, but then the state kind of isn't that necessarily diligent in kind of like policing the medical ethics. A couple years ago, I went to a continuing legal education, and this woman from the Pennsylvania bar, professional responsibility people. I'm blanking on what they call them here. But she literally got up and she gave this talk and she wagged her finger at us and said, "We're coming after you." You never see that in medicine. And you don't really see that in any place else except for law. And she was really obnoxious. And because of the lack of hierarchy, then it's really for people to say, well, something's ethical or unethical. They have to kind of like say, well, do I believe them? Do I ascribe to those sets of values? In some ways, the American Medical Association's code of ethics is kind of like a moral code for practice of medicine. But not everybody signs on to it. Just like the Ten Commandments, not all Christians probably wind up signing up lock, stock, and barrel to all Ten Commandments. And this was reflected in Sillamar. It was kind of an example of the lack of a hierarchy and a lack of anybody who's going to be able to control medicine. So Sillamar, was there any reading on Sillamar? Did I give you anything on it? No? Anybody ever heard of it? No. So Sillamar was a meeting of leading geneticists back in 1976. And it followed, this is the beginning of the recombinant DNA age, and there was concern in numerous communities around the country about recombinant technologies that people were going to be making, kind of like crazy bugs or crazy plants and releasing them into the countryside, and who knew what was going to happen with that. So Cambridge, Massachusetts, and then Berkeley, California, and then a bunch of other states, I think it was about 100 county municipalities around the country, enacted ordinances basically prohibiting the use of recombinant DNA technology in their jurisdictions. And think about Cambridge, Mass, and Berkeley, California, and you've got three of the biggest research institutions in the country. And so there was the scientists basically got together. I think David Baltimore, whose name will come up again, was one of the critical organizers of this. And they met in Sillamar, which is in California, just southwest of San Francisco, on the coast. And they had a meeting, and they basically decided that they would impose a temporary ban on the technologies, pending generation of kind of safe practices for containment. Make sure that basically contain it until you figured out that it's safe, that it's not going to go off and become a wonder bug and kind of kill all other bugs and us. they had no real authority. I mean, all they had was the power of persuasion to kind of go out to their community, to their colleagues in the field, and say, this is what we should be doing as a field. Right? And that, fortunately, they were big enough names. I mean, Baltimore had a Nobel, and you know, there were big enough names there that they had some persuasive authority over their colleagues, but they really couldn't control them. Right? Any questions about this? So here's the scientific community. And if you think about what the scientist, the individual scientist is doing, I mean, we think of it as a community, but actually it's much more nuanced. We're a community of kind of competitors, and we're colleagues and competitors, we're codependents in the sense that we have to work for each other. We do work for each other, we peer review each other's science, but we're also competitors with those same people. And we're competing for limited research dollars with people. And it makes for some crazy politics and everything else. But you can think of your individual scientist, and you have all these colleagues in your same department, and maybe a competitor in the same department, and these people could be in firms and other universities. They can be tied by a field of inquiry or a discipline. They're all scientists, and of course we're all subject to society. Right? And I think this is a useful heuristic for thinking about how the individual science, what pressures the individual scientist is under. Right? The rat is saying defunding increases aggression. So one of those pressures that's on scientists, which we'll talk about again, is the need to get grant funding, and that's where the competition comes in so heavily, because the grant funds are limited. Sorry. All right. So society, ultimately we're all kind of like part and parcel of society, right? And society can socially regulate and regulate technologies. And social regulation of science has been highly reactive to revealed problems in science. And we're going to talk about, through this class, we're going to talk about protection of animals and humans, as well as, I mean, next week is scientific integrity, and we'll talk about conflicts of interest. These have all been kind of regulated at some level, mostly by the federal government, and it's all tied to public funding. I mean, the federal government's link to kind of regulation of science in the United States is tied to money. There's another restriction that's kind of come up, and this is the idea of restricting forbidden science. Right? And this has come up in various kind of like dangerous technologies. There's behind forbidden science is this idea that there are certain things we shouldn't know. Or there's certain, sometimes some people say, well, we'd like to know the knowledge, but there's no ethical way to find that knowledge. And that could speak to certain kinds of human subjects or even animals kinds of research. You can even think of what the Nazis were doing. Clear examples might be nuclear technology. I mean, clearly we don't want how to make a bomb in everybody's hands. And then it's come up more recently with stem cells and reproductive cloning. So the issue there is, as you see in the case that we'll talk about tonight, is about the moral status of an embryo. And of course, you know, to the extent that society can regulate, especially through the power of the purse, there are risks of social control. And if anybody got to the paper in the readings on Lysenko, did anybody get to that? Yeah, I mean, Lysenko, anybody know who Lysenko was? No. There was a paper from Science, 1949 or something, where from a biologist. And so like Lysenko was a plant biologist in Russia who became very powerful in the sciences academy there. And he, for a period of years, dictated the dogma of Lamarckism. Lamarckianism? Is that how you say that word? Anybody? So Lamarck basically was had the theory back in the 1800s of what is it called? When genes...
Inherited traits.
Thank you. So, and that for whatever reason, this guy basically dictated that this is the direction in which Soviet genetics was going to go. And for years, he dictated that. And the science just kind of like it was heading in the right direction, and then it just kind of like went off on this beaten path, this trail that was just crazy. And people were really literally afraid. There were people who were sent off to the camps and killed, and it was purely, it was just crazy. And anyway, so that's... in some sense that's the issue. I mean, it's money and power, right? And money, we have money. I mean, you know, the NIH here spends $30 billion per year on research, and while we like to think that a lot of it is kind of like dictated by peer review, nonetheless there are decisions that are made at fairly high levels about where the money's going to go, what's going to get prioritized. And some of the, you can always question, like we were questioning about the priorities of kind of treating HIV instead of heart disease and diabetes and stuff like that last week. I mean, the same thing can be said now about the research agenda. Is it purely driven by science? No. And should it be purely driven by science? What do you think?
I think it's based upon the evidence base. I mean, if the science is there to move the argument in one direction or the other, I say yes. But if the body of knowledge is not there, then I would say you probably have to do something else because you don't have.
Well, isn't the problem though that you have lots of scientists clamoring around trying to do good science, and somebody has to make and you have a limited pool of money. So somebody at some level is going to have to make a prioritization decision about where are we going to put our money?
Yeah.
And scientists follow the money. Just like everybody else, we're not special in that way. It says the government still won't fund our stem cell experiments, Igor. I think they're living in the dark ages. This is all forbidden knowledge. So, look, stem cells in Lipitor from Uncle Henri in Quebec. And this gets back to your point. This is the inevitable intersection on the road of life, is morally right and legally right, and they don't necessarily intersect. Right. So, you'll see what I do through this class is I'll use humor to kind of highlight some points. And then at the end of the semester, we'll go through all the humor and I'll bring everything flowing back to you. All right, so what are the ethics of science? There are ethics. So, from the sociological perspective, and this is kind of an attempt at a descriptive approach to ethics, Robert Merton was a sociologist. He described the generalized norms of science. He described these four norms. He said there was universalism, where equality is judged by scientific standards alone. A communal, what he called communism, but it's come to become called communalism because of the loaded nature of communism, which is a sharing and communicating within that community that we're all in this, we're all driven by the same desire to find the truth and publish it and share and the like. Disinterestedness, and here the primary concern is advancement of knowledge, so we basically don't have conflicts and we try to have this detachment, right, from our hypotheses. And along the same lines, organized skepticism. And this is within the community itself, that it takes two studies to kind of believe something, kind of thing. You subject all findings and research to scrutiny and repetition and validation and basically critical review. This is where peer review comes in and duplication of studies. Of course, nobody really likes to duplicate, and we'll talk about this again when it comes to authorship, but nobody really likes to duplicate the work that somebody else has done because you don't get any real credit for duplicating the work. You can get credit for showing that it wasn't true. Cornand extended this more recently with an overlapping set. He said that there was the integrity and objectivity, so he said there's truth-telling and avoiding what he called undisciplined introduction of subjective elements into observation, what we could also call the conflicts of interest or other sources of bias, which we'll talk about. There's tolerance for the good faith efforts of others, recognizing that we're all in a common enterprise seeking truth. There's the doubt of certitude, which was kind of like the disinterestedness. So it's a questioning attitude. You have to go into something questioning. You don't believe it. A recognition of error. So he actually said that there was a duty to recognize, acknowledge, and admit error. So if you come across something that's not correct, or you've made a mistake, and you have an obligation to the scientific community to correct it and put it out there, make sure that other people. I mean, one of the things that's always said about scientists stand on the shoulders of those who came before them. And if the science isn't trustworthy, it's not true, then people will be wasting resources, they'll go down bad pathways, and let's see the arguments. So they should have unselfish engagement. And by the way, I'll post these slides, so if you, they'll be on Blackboard for today. should be unselfish engagement. So the primary purpose should be extending knowledge, right? That's same as the disinterestedness. And he said again, the communal spirit. And here we have to, my interpretation of this was to appreciate and respect the codependence, that we're all in this together and we're all dependent upon each other in a way. Right?
John, just,
yeah.
If you would measure uninterestedness, how would you do it? Because that's difficult.
Right. And again, it's actually very hard not to have some prior beliefs about what you're studying. Many scientists are probably vested in something, right, in one way or another. And it often comes, I'm always kind of interested because from a statistical perspective, when you state a hypothesis, your null hypothesis is that things are equal, right? Or you state the null, it's like, well, what do you expect? What are you looking to disprove? And people often will state hypotheses as what they believe or what they kind of hope the study will show, which is the alternative hypothesis. And in some sense, there's a very subtle bias there, because in some ways you can actually design your study. It would be kind of a bias there. It's called a
selection.
I'm sorry.
Selection.
No, it's anybody know this one? When you'll design a study that is slightly more likely, just because from the design of it, to affirm your prior hypothesis instead of trying to disprove it. I'm sorry?
Self-fulfilling.
It's kind of like that, but there's a term, there's a certain bias, and it can be very subtle. I mean, we know that studies are designed and can be designed in somewhat flawed ways. I mean, one of the ways we know it happens is it may be purposeful sometimes or not, but it's in the choice of controls. And sometimes if you have a drug and you want to compare it to somebody else, some other drug that's existing in the existing therapy, are you going to take, depending on who you are and what your purpose is, you may not take the best currently available therapy. That happens. But and if you're the IRB or if you're kind of overlooking that, you have to question it. You know, it's like, well, why are they using that controller to control instead of something else? But that's a fairly palpable one. And there are more subtle biases about the selection of subjects and the inclusion and exclusion criteria in subjects. This is just thinking about trials. And even other social sciences as well can be subtly influenced by our expectations and our hopes. And I don't think it's always acknowledged that way. Sociology is pretty good at kind of navel-gazing on this. And I mean, they know, especially because sociology deals with underprivileged, you know, people and kind of vulnerable subjects, people, vulnerable populations, and they're very aware of the politics and the political influences on their field and on the practitioners in their field. Now, whether or not that's enough to offset it, who knows? Yeah. Ultimately, scientists are subjected to this kind of pressure. So behind one door is tenure, behind the other is flipping burgers at McDonald's. Come on, this is funny.
Because of McDonald's?
I'm sorry?
Because of McDonald's?
Yeah. Well, flipping burgers, yeah. Maybe it actually gets a little too close to home sometimes. All right. So there are other ethical norms of science. And here I've listed a bunch. And I don't know if anybody has any additional ones, but I'll throw these out here. We've got intellectual integrity and honesty. We're going to have to tell the truth and trustworthiness. This is probably first and foremost in science. I mean, we're looking for truth. We're trying to describe the world around us. And because we all stand on the shoulders of those who went before us, we believe what what others have published and what others tell us. And we want to build on that, and that's the way science grows. That's the way our knowledge base grows, right? And when somebody violates that, they've done something that's really, really bad for science. Right? There's collegiality and the sharing of ideas and data. This is too often honored in the term I'm looking for in the breach. Thank you. So. There are just too many cases of people stealing ideas. I mean, one of the things you'll hear from scientists, I don't know if any young scientists here have had this happen to them, but you know, you go off into a conference and you talk about your work, and lo and behold, you get scooped by somebody who was at the conference, and here's your work. hears you talk and stuff. And of course, they don't give you credit, right? Because that would be a bad idea. So this too often, and I think it's only been getting worse in the last 20 or 30 years with the advent of commercial interests. In fact, there's been, nicely if you look at New England Journal, if you look in Nature, I remember a couple of years ago there was an article, or just a letter to the editor saying that, you know, somebody had published some data on a protein, something or other that they had, and synthesized, and they called them up and asked if they could access some of it, and they said, no, we've already got too many colleagues, and too many people we're collaborating with, and we're not willing to share any further than that. And the letter to Nature was like, you know, that's not fair. I mean, it should be kind of like, on the other hand, sometimes it costs a lot of money to kind of like share with somebody. So somebody, do you meet all comers, or how do you filter that? Right? And of course, if they come in with money, it's all to the good. There's obviously a big duty to publish and disseminate your findings. Right? And this is all from the Bentley Glass article, as well as Cornand's paper. There's a duty to educate, mentor, and train the next generation. Of course, this is very self-serving, right? We all want scientists, we want the next generation to kind of validate the science that we do and its importance. You have to defend the freedom of inquiry and academic freedom and to the death, Bentley Glass said, right? Never heard anybody really suggest that was a good idea, but okay. We have duty to give credit where due, right? And then this speaks back to the kind of sharing. If you see somebody else's idea, then why not share with them the idea? And some years ago, I had a student, she was a graduate student here, and I was doing one study, and she suggested a little bit of a tangential study that would require some different kind of data collection and analysis. So I wound up doing it, and then I called her and said, you know, I got the data, and you want to participate in the analysis of this and the writing of the paper. And she was busy, she was finishing her PhD, and she said, no thanks. So I just acknowledged her for the idea. And it's funny, because people don't want to do that. It's like, oh, well, you don't get full credit if in the acknowledgments you acknowledge somebody else for almost anything. And they won't really kind of like, and I'm not sure why. Because I still did the research. Nobody's going to go back and look, and nobody, like the tenure committee, is not going to go back and look at the footnote and say, it wasn't even his idea. Doesn't happen. Anyway, nonetheless, people, you know, we have this obligation to give credit, and that is. And one question here is actually about the cultural norms of that. And one of the things that's been coming clear in the last couple of years is the incidence of misconduct, which we'll talk about next week, in non-U.S. and even, you know, just kind of say non-U.S. Places. We don't know what the incidence is of misconduct. But the big revelations in the last couple of years have been in Europe, China, India, and other places. And one of the questions is whether or not the same kind of scientific attitudes and morals apply in those places. And it's funny because a colleague of mine teaches in Holland, and he teaches about plagiarism in Holland. And he said that the Dutch students are very much into paying somebody respect by copying their work. And to them, it's almost like he said it's like this cultural thing. It's like, well, you know, I really respect the way this is written, so I used it myself. It's like, okay, but put quotes around and cite it. Otherwise, it's plagiarism. It's a duty to perform peer review and refereeing activities. This is kind of like a lesser duty, but this is more pragmatic. This is, you know, when it gets down to being a practicing scientist, this is one of the kind of the unfunded mandates that you're required to do. And to try to do it well. You have a duty to engage in public discourse, especially when you start publishing. The newspapers obviously are interested in science. There's science writers all over the place, and they call you up and they try to talk to you about your science and they try to present it to the public. And sometimes they'll try to take it and do a little more with it than you really want them to do with it. They want to, you know, they're into sensational stories. Oftentimes, when they call up, you know, you've got a big quantitative study of like lots of data, and they want the story. You know, they want to put a human face on it, right? So they're going to ask for those human faces. In clinical trials, this becomes an issue because sometimes the press comes in and they want to know one of the subjects that's been in the trial, and they want to interview them. And then you have to kind of like figure out how you're going to, if you want to do that, and go down the path finding one of the subjects who's willing to talk about it. And here the question is also, is the obligation to, I mean, what is your, should you, and I'll put this out to the group, is should you limit your engagement to the bounds of your profession, of your scientific knowledge? Or if because you have a mouthpiece, are you allowed to kind of like go off and opine? Okay. And it's an interesting question, I think. To make the question clear?
How far out of your own realm are we talking?
Yeah, that's the question, right? How far? Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you did a study and they want to, I guess it's all extrapolation. I mean, in some sense, you've done a study and the press is looking for the external, I mean, they want an externally valid, they want something that's transportable. They want to know that your results tell them something about the world. Whereas all you've kind of like looked at is a very maybe perhaps narrow question. And yes, you can then make some leaps and draw some conclusions that might have policy or other kind of ramifications for the world at large. And it's a good question. It's like, how far do you feel comfortable going, and how far does your data justify you going?
I think that you can, I would imagine that you could go almost as far as you want to, as long as you delineate, or as long as you explain that the difference between what is your opinion and what is factually, what you can factually back up. Obviously, you can point to what you've done to lead you to explain that you have, I guess, you're informed in some degree. But I mean, I don't understand. I'm not seeing why there would be an issue as long as you delineate that it's not not factual. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I think
I agree.
A basic research scientist would have a duty to be familiar with the way the media is going to interpret it and publish it. And so, if he says, "You think that this very specific study at the cellular level has implications for cancer," he has to know that the media's going to take that in. Like, or all
cancer
read it
and cured.
Be like, "This causes cancer for sure," or like, "This will cure it." So, right. I think there is like, it's a very sensitive issue, and they should be more informed about how the media arranges things.
True. Sometimes it could be clear from the questioning of the media. So for years ago, in fact, in our readings, when I get the human subject stuff, I've got a paper we did, I almost published in Science, that basically looked at the use of human tissues in research and showed that about 20% of the studies, published studies in some leading journals, had not been IRB approved, even though they used identified samples and they should have technically been reviewed by IRBs. And I got a call from the BBC and they were like, "Does this mean that people's rights are being trumped?" And I was like, "No." So it didn't appear. You know, I basically talked them down off of the ledge. But you have to kind of be willing to do that, because that was the only time I've ever talked to anybody from the BBC, which was kind of cool. But you know, but it was also interesting. There's another paper. You know, the journals, to the extent that the journals have gotten into this, so some of the leading journals are highly competitive. So Nature and Science are vying. They're both distribution of 700,000 copies per month or week per week, and you know they're really famous and they get quoted by all the press, and the press is always looking for big science to come out in those journals, and they're really competitive between themselves. But I published a paper there some years ago, and the editors actually took out text boxes. You know, and I was uncomfortable with their text boxes, because that text box became a statement. This was about gene patenting, right? And the statement was really outrageous, patients are dying, kind of thing. And it's like, no patients aren't dying. You really can't show that any patients have been denied access to services because of this. But you know, just arguably, it definitely raises the cost, but it may raise the availability. I don't know. Who knows? But even in the publication itself, we had to kind of like talk the editors down and just, you know, not let them run amok with the data. Because ultimately, if they had done that, I would have been responsible for it. But, oops. All right. And this other thing about the public discourse is that this is unfunded also. Right? The scientists, I mean, sometimes, you know, if you publish a really hot paper, you're going to get a lot of phone calls. People are going to be trying to do interview TV and everything else. And sometimes it can be fun, But it's, you know, it's time consuming and it can be stressful. So. All right, there's a duty to comply with the law. Hopefully that would be not hard to say, hard to do, but you never know. And then finally, the last one I'd throw here is a duty to blow the whistle. So, and this gets back to Cornyn's issue about kind of revealing error if you find it. The problem, of course, and we'll talk about this next week with blowing the whistle, is that whistleblowers still get thrown to the wolves oftentimes. So, am I missing anything? Can you think of anything? It's a hard question. Just dumping a list on you. Okay. So it's not our job to ask why we got a grant to research why it crossed the road. It's our job to pretend we're earning it. All right. So, are ethics enforced? And this is where this is a point of departure for next week's readings. The misconduct is directed to those wrongs that undermine the veracity of the scientific record. So when you think about misconduct this week, when you do the readings and the case for next week, think about that, right? Why is this scientific or research misconduct? And why isn't it, why are all these other things kind of like in part of the ethics, but misconduct is narrowly drawn to these two things? And these other things are kind of enforced, but in very informal ways, right? I mean, if you don't do peer review, you know, yeah, you're not going to lose your job or anything like that. I mean, doing peer review for a lot of journals looks good on your CV, but nobody's ever going to really yell at you for not doing it. And complying with law, of course, that has its own formal set of sanctions attached to it, but it's not misconduct. Anyway, and finally I'll finish with this. This is what happens when ethical standards are set artificially high.
But Jan, I mean, if you have an idea that is very interesting, but I publish ahead of time, because there is a rule how to establish who is the patentor. Mm-hmm. But how to deal with that?
That priority?
Yeah.
So the submission dates, right? I mean, the journals will look at...
But if you don't have proofs, because they state that you have to schedule everything you have done, mm-hmm. Sometimes you don't have.
Yeah, so this actually gets to the notebook. And I mean, it's publishing, but depending on what your science discipline is, I mean, how do you document when what you've done? From an intellectual property perspective and from a good note-taking perspective, I mean, writing down, keeping a research notebook that has, and I don't do this, me but my bad, but maybe because I'm not sure why I don't, but I don't. I don't think I learned, but especially in the biological sciences and the physical sciences, people do this, right? Social sciences, not so much, but keep a running notebook that has, it's dated and everything's right in there, and every page is taken up. I mean, next week we'll talk about the data in my case. So this woman, Therese Imanishi Carey, got herself accused and then found guilty of scientific misconduct, and then ultimately the charges were dropped. I mean, she was exonerated, but she kept very bad notes. She literally, I mean, she was doing, I don't know, some kind of molecular biology, and she literally would take tapes and print out and kind of like put them on the windowsills where they were getting bleached by the sun at differential rates, and she was a mess. And her English wasn't, she wasn't a native English speaker. She spoke like four or five other languages, and English was the last of them, and she just had various issues. And then somebody questioned the data, and she didn't have really sound notebooks to back it up. Of course, her notebooks were subjected to scrutiny by the Secret Service, which, yeah, we can talk about that case next week. You have a reading on the case. But you know, the idea of keeping really good notebooks is good in case anybody ever questions your data, about the veracity of the data, but also for priority. I mean, the problem with priority is that it sometimes is a little bit ambiguous. Unless you get into a patent fight, nobody's going to go kind of like look back at the notebooks to figure out who really had priority. It's usually which one appeared in the press, who's going to get the name recognition for the thing. And sometimes this bites people, bites scientists in the butt. I had a professor at Carnegie Mellon when I was there. He had gone off to a different school at CMU. He had gone to a different school and given a talk. on a work, and he had actually written, he's an economist by training, he had written this paper up and submitted to an economics journal, a good economics journal, and literally had like a 2-year lead time before it would appear in print. And there was a junior faculty from this other school there, and this person kind of like took the idea and embellished on it and published it in a kind of a third tier journal that came out 3 months later and kind of scooped him. Mm-hmm. And the funny thing is that people in the know knew that this guy Lester was the real source of this. But this other guy, you know, the other thing is that you don't do that to a senior professor at your university. Bad idea. But I don't know if it ever came back to root, like if the guy had tenure or not. I don't know if it ever came back to haunt him. But you know, nobody's going to really question, I don't think, at that level. When it comes down to patents, yeah. I mean, that's when if you're ever doing something that in patentable technology, having that notebook becomes critical, especially in the United States, although less so. And the reason it's less so, I'm sorry, I don't want to get into patent law too much, but patent law used to reward in the US up until recently, it would reward a patent to the first to invent, not the first to file. And we recently passed an amendment to the patent law that switches, like the rest of the world, to a first to file system. So we're getting rid of the system that would look back at your notebooks and decide who's the first to invent, and then using due diligence, reduce it to practice, and then file a patent application. So. I can go more into detail later if you want to know about this stuff. All right. So, the one question is about regulation. And does science regulate itself? You know, you've got all of these different things, and yeah, I said there's formal sanctions of that misconduct, and then there's the informal sanctions that try to kind of like regulate the way that people behave as scientists. And how do we do? And does science, or does any field really regulate itself?
Does any human really regulate themselves? I mean, really, if you look at society as a whole, right? You can use science is just a group of people that are, and right. So there are going to be those who absolutely self-regulate and can, you know, peer pressure or just. Conforming to norms, mm-hmm. and then there are going to be those who flaunt that, who kind of go outside the rules. So I think that science is no different than society in that. But I think that part of the problem with science and medicine is that there seems to be a lot more at stake, people's health, people's lives, right? The perception is that. People with specialized training should be above being human in a way, right? Mm-hmm. But it's true. You can't.
So we can't expect more out of us.
I think that it's very noble to expect more from out of us. But I mean, so if so in. Scientists and doctors are self-selected, right? I wake up and I decide I want to do this. So it's not that I have to pass some moral test to say whether or not I'd be one of these self-regulating people or not.
That's true.
Right? So.
But it's also, I guess in some ways, self-regulating also raises the question of standards, because individuals may not believe that these sets of norms apply to them. So, which could be problematic. But then the question really remains is whether or not science does anything about people who violate those norms. And are those punishments or those mechanisms appropriate or not? So, and the answer here, there are various mechanisms that we use to kind of like police conduct and all, and peer review is one. We use peer review in various ways. Obviously, peer review of journal articles and books and stuff like that is a way to kind of check the quality of people's works, whether or not they're actually complying with the norms, the methodological norms that we expect of them. Whether or not they're telling the truth, though, peer review is notoriously bad at detecting fraud, which we could talk about next week. But it's just you can't. If somebody wants to cook data and they're good at it, you're not going to find it. Yeah.
weren't Wakefield's publications on the autism research were peer reviewed, but weren't, I thought the peer reviewers raised a lot of questions that the journals ended up ignoring.
Mm-hmm. That happened actually with Schoen too. So we can talk about that next week. But but peer review, I mean, if you're good at it, right? And I mean, if you're too good, like the guy Schoen. Schoen was a Bell Labs researcher who was cooking data in physics, and you know, everybody thought he was like a rising star on his way to a Nobel, and it was all cooked data. And he had 18, I think, at the end of the day, 17 or 18 articles in Science and Nature and Physics Review Letters all yanked. And Wakefield, I forget, what was the story?
It was the supposed link between vaccinations and
autism. Yeah, yeah. Which,
The journals have all retracted.
Right.
And he's lost his license of practice. I mean, that's another...
In the UK. Right. Actually, that's an interesting thing about the UK, is the UK takes this stuff seriously. If you violate consent rules and stuff like that in the UK, you can lose, you get stricken from the roles. Whereas here in the US, you're free to kind of leave.
But sometimes it takes too much time, because that's happened in 1998. And as long as that was not clear about how does it was done, too many things will happen. And, well, until now, the things clear up. But as long as that, he get too many profits, and he patented because he already was having a kit of some more safety vaccine, and he got it. So now he can be like with enough public confidence, but he got something that can be for as long as he can be living.
There is also a long-lasting effect of that article. Vaccination rates for the MMR vaccine in the UK are way lower than other countries because the confidence of the public has been broken. And even if 13 of the 14 people on their article said we retract, mm-hmm. the harm is done.
Mm-hmm. It's true. It's out there. Yeah.
Well, right. Also, what happens when an article is retracted? It still exists and the retraction is actually separate. So if you go into PubMed or Medline or anything, you can actually still get that article, and there's not always a note that flashes up that says, warning, this article's been retracted. You would actually have to search for that. So, if you don't know.
It also turns out that a lot of articles are retracted, and it's like, and instead of saying, well, this guy was convicted by the Office for Research Integrity of Scientific Misconduct for fabricating data, the retraction might say because it was the data was irreproducible or something like that. And the retraction statements are oftentimes really ambiguous. It's really garbage. Yeah.
I think you also have to look at, though, even if there was more regulation, it wasn't self-regulated, people would still publish false results or make up results. So if there's outside regulation or more power for regulation in science, that would just mean the penalties potentially could be harsher. And at some point, increasing the penalties isn't really going to do anything. So despite the fact that there is some self-regulation if the paper was retracted, and eventually, especially if something's mainstream, the more mainstream it's going to get, the more likely you'll be caught if you fake it. So I think, there's always going to be falsity in some sense. And so I'd say the fact that the person was caught, if at least you're in the mainstream, there is going to be self-regulation.
Yeah. There's also, the cases that we know about are for, at least for misconduct, are kind of usually pretty outrageous.
Yeah.
And it's these other practices that sometimes you have to really wonder, it's like, how do people continue to get away with this junk? And if you read this week, there's stuff about Robert Gallo, who was, by all, from what I can tell, he was just a total sleazeball, but extremely powerful, and so he was implicated in How do you say this nicely? He kind of stole credit for discovery of HIV from Montagnier in France. And there's a whole rich history of this, and fortunately Montagnier got the Nobel for it, and Gallo didn't. And Gallo left the NCI, and I guess he was NCI, and he went to University of Maryland, where they gave him $100 million center. And the guy's a sleazeball. Anybody, he kind of dodged the bullet because he was above the too powerful to kind of take down or something. But So, but it's like people get reputations, and I guess the misconduct is at one end. Right? I mean, we'll talk about this next week, but you know, the inability. We don't know how frequent misconduct is. We don't know how to catch it. It's kind of usually caught by either by whistleblowers or serendipity, or because they were really bad at cooking data, and somebody finally came to question their work. But it's the other kinds of practices, like the reputation of going off and sleazing and taking advantage of other people or younger people, and younger trainees and stuff like that, which people do. And people do get reputations, but you know, they also, if they're publishing and they get promoted, and they get power, and they get into powerful places. But I guess that's just like anything else. Science is like anything else in that way. All right. So why don't we talk about the case? Anybody? Questions? Case number one. So I just wanted to be clear that so the cases, anybody got any questions about the order of the cases and which one is to be chosen for the editorial? Any questions about this? So it's the four cases for the next 4 weeks, tonight and the next 3 weeks after this. Right? It's four cases. And each in Blackboard, it's the case that's right on the main page. It says case one, two, three, and four. And you have to choose one of those cases for the write-up. Okay? Everybody's on page. There are, if you look on tonight's Blackboard, there's a description of the first task, the essay, the editorial. And in that directory, in that folder, I've included two essay editorials that I wrote. So if you go digging in, if you want to see, I give them to you just to get, you get a sense of like what's appropriate to write as an editorial. And sometimes people, you know, if they'll publish a science paper, they will take an editorial that talks about some aspect of the paper. So that's the nature of the thing. For the guideline though, you have to go to Science's page for authors. Okay. So we have a case. The other thing is we have the case. The class goes nominally till 7, and we can take a break, like a 5 or 10 minute break in the middle of this, or we can continue. And that goes. I mean, some nights I think will be a little longer than others. So it's really kind of a question of how long do you want to just sit here, or do you want to take 5 minutes. Anybody, any feeling about it? It's a democratic process. Does anybody have any real need to get out of here early? I do. Well, why don't we tough it out, because I don't think this will take that long, and we can get out of here early. Okay. So, anybody want to say any observations about the case, any issues?
I found out 5, 6, 7.
Well, don't say them. Pick one.
Okay.
Pick the biggest one.
As we considered he made plagiarism. So
he made, I'm sorry?
He made plagiarism because he attended the conference,
mm-hmm.
and he heard about the idea,
mm-hmm.
which he never had already think about it. So in that way, the plagiarism was done,
right.
Which is kind of misconduct.
Right. It's kind of taking somebody else's idea and running with it. So who owns ideas?
Who owns in that case?
Who owns an idea? Anybody? Can you own an idea?
Yeah, but I mean, how interesting the idea of new improvement in some issues that make the difference, because I can have many ideas,
mm-hmm.
but if you are looking for something specific, that's different.
It's actually the embodiment. So she, you're right. She, what was her name? Tend.
Tend.
So Tend revealed in Japan a method for doing something that people hadn't been able to do. The idea itself may not have been that unique or practical. I mean, people may not have been able to do it for various reasons. So she basically came up with a method to do it. Okay? And then he... So is it, I guess one question is plagiarism. Plagiarism is copying somebody else's work without credit? Plagiarism, yeah.
I mean, I don't know about it's fictional, but what if the idea is she presented like something or method on animals, and he copied the method on humans? Would this be like stealing an idea, or?
It's interesting because it might not work in humans. I mean, the question is, I guess then, well, anybody else want to respond to that?
I think that even if he had just borrowed it and like applied it to another situation, I think you'd still have to acknowledge that. So it brings up the issue of like unacknowledged borrowing, that even if you're just taking an idea and kind of changing it a little bit, I think you're still supposed to cite that information.
Yeah, to say it, or you can acknowledge in your paper.
Sure. You know, the funny thing is, like I said earlier, it's like, you know, he was the first to get, if he could do it, it's been done. I mean, we know that cloning has been done in other species, but you can't do it in humans for various reasons. And if he was the first to do it, you know, more power to him, but I mean, why not cite the earlier work? And I think scientists, I don't get it totally. I mean, I think the good scientists will, but too often scientists don't. Like there was a paper published, I may have mentioned this last week, there was a paper published last year. That was a really, really great design. I wish I had thought of this. But they went back and they looked at clinical trials. The question was whether or not people who were publishing clinical trials cited clinical trials on the same issue that had been published before. Right? So they looked at meta-analyses published from 1967 or so through whenever they finished the study, like 2 years ago. Meta-analyses are basically reviews of all, you know, all of the literature. All the trials on a particular subject. They looked at the meta-analyses. They pulled the studies from the meta that were cited in the meta-analyses, and then they looked at the papers that were cited in the meta-analyses, seeing if they cited other papers cited by the meta-analysis that had been published at least 1 year prior to the data publication of that trial. Right? Great idea, right? It was using the meta-analysis as their kind of like their entry point into the literature was great. So meta-analysis will be very, very thorough in identifying clinical trials. But it turned out that about 25 to 30% of those trials did not cite prior trials, I forget exactly, but it was about 25 to 30% non-citation rate. I forget exactly what it was. Which was really shockingly high. I mean, we know that people don't cite competing work. I mean, I've had my own work not cited, which really ticks me off, and I've had other people who don't cite prior work. And it's like, why? You know? And it's actually, I think it's much more convoluted than just me, scientists not wanting to own up to prior work. I think editors also play a role, because editors don't want 1,000 references. So you as a writer, when you're writing something, you will run into kind of like editorial restrictions, like in the article you're supposed to write for edit science, you're limited to 10. So which 10? I mean, and how do you choose that? And what do the peer reviewers say? I reviewed a paper for Science a couple of years ago. It was a policy forum, and it was interesting because it was really, really good analysis. They took the patent and trademark database on patented human gene sequences, and they matched it to the gene sequence, Hugo or whatever, what is the Human Genome Organization's sequence database, right? Which is a really great idea. And they matched them, and they decided that, they determined that about 20% of human genes were patented. And a lot of these, they kind of like could show, were they coming out of Insight and other companies, or were they out of universities? And then they could also show what genes they were on. Were they breast cancer genes, which turns out the breast cancer genes were amongst the most prevalent patented genes. And then people focused on disease-causing genes and human diseases. Anyway, it was a really cool analysis, but there were two prior studies that had shown that in university settings, at least, that about 20%, 15 to 20% of patent disclosures, inventions, are patented. So their 20% was very much in line with prior data. Right? So I suggested that maybe that should be cited. And then the final paper came out in Science and it wasn't cited. And I was just like, well, why not? I mean, in some sense, the 20% is not a magic number. All the other details that they threw in there was what they really contributed. Right? And not so much the 20%. but they didn't cite it. And that very much was an editorial decision. So it is, you can't just point your fingers at the scientists. But I would like to have known, what did the scientists say to the editors that they didn't, you know, they agreed that they wouldn't have to cite those prior papers. It's kind of strange. Anyway. What else? Yeah.
I mean, even if he did get informed consent from these donors, he didn't give them enough time to possibly take in the interest, the market value of what the research could produce, and didn't give enough time frame, I guess, for adequate like questions for eliciting and answering donor questions.
Which case did you do?
Case one.
What you're really meaning is that because he just called and in 4 days they developed the idea, so they overpass this step of IRB.
Yeah, they
did. Which in that case, who would they direct to if will be done?
Where do you see consent?
I'm inferring from the way he gets the embryos, the end use says right away.
Oh yeah, so that was, I mean, so one of the things about when you're identifying issues, you want to stay fairly limited to the facts that you have available to you. So there's no mention of human subjects here, so you really don't know where the source of the embryos is. Right? So you're really kind of extrapolating a little bit beyond the facts available to you. I mean, you could also look at that and say, well, he had to get IRB approval, and he had to do this and this, and you don't know on these facts that that's true. He could have embryos, they're human embryos, they're totally de-identified, which may or may not, depending on what you think the status of the embryo is, may or may not be adequate. But you know, he may have been able to do this without kind of going even through an embryonic stem cell research board. So he could, I mean, so you don't go beyond the facts. In other words, so take the fact that you've got and try to then tie that to an issue. Right. Yeah.
Yeah, the other ones that I identified was the financial interest that he and the Institute, the Madison Institute of Technology, has on his clone cell technologies, right? So, and you know that when you have a financial interest in this, can push down your results, so a positive outcome will benefit the shareholders at the end. So that's a problem. He has double pay on this because there also was the associate director of the journal, which he was sending his own article. So, yeah, so paying really bad on that. And, yeah, and the authorship also, when he decided to go with his paper, whether including his team work, and also we don't acknowledge the work of this person, right? So what we've mentioned before.
Mm-hmm. Right, those are pretty much all problems. We'll talk about the conflicts in 2 weeks. The conflicts issue, it'll come up again. You'll see Dr. Seed again. and the authorship issue is real. And it's like, authors are people, and we have, when we get to the authorship week, I mean, authors are people who have contributed to the performance and conception and and publication of work. People who are responsible for it. So, and the people here, in some sense, I mean, the guy did the right thing. If they had a real kind of cutting edge thing, you put yourself on there. And this is the order of the graduate students, was that right? You know, he put himself in the first paper that the postdoc wrote. Anybody have any problem with that?
Yeah, so the first author is awards invited, in this case for the thesis would be you, right, the first author. Mm-hmm. And usually the last one is your mentor. And right. You can include many people, you bias that and move between them.
Right. And that's true in biomedicine.
Yes.
Right. In other fields, it's not necessarily true. In other fields, you might actually consider, for instance, putting one order in order of contribution. in some fields, some of the social sciences, more than one author basically undermines the ability of somebody to claim the paper. And I know for a fact that, you know, it's like, people who will have contributed to a paper don't get mentioned as authors, they'll get thanked in the acknowledgments, so that one person shows up. In sociology, if you have multiple papers, they will literally not count your papers, because they're not yours alone, which is crazy speaking. It's like, how do they really know who did what and who's attributable, who's who, you get the issue. but you know.
And sometimes in crazy physics paper, they just list people in alphabetical order because there's 150.
Mm-hmm. In medicine, they'll do that too. But they'll say that's what they did, right? Yeah, and sometimes, and we'll talk about authorship issues, but it's a problem, especially here, because of the students and the power hierarchy. And this is really an abuse of students, and on various levels, this was abusive. But anything else? Yeah.
Just kind of violation of the duty to communicate. We kind of talked about this a little bit, but he kind of publishes in an obscure journal that he already has like this connection to. So it's not being published in a place where everyone will have access to it, be able to, you know, ensure that other people can find it and cite it. Like the whole issue of secrecy in general.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Yeah.
just from what you mentioned earlier regarding the way the patent law has changed. I think it's interesting that you kind of have this question of what's morally right and what's legally right in a sense, because I guess, who is it, Tin has, as far as the actual patenting of this method to do something, she hasn't done anything to patent it, as far as we know from this.
Right. She may have.
Or yeah. I guess you don't know that from these facts, but it seems like he's the first person to file here. In that right, he would have the right to the patent.
Arguably, yes.
Okay.
But the patent, it also requires that somebody be truthful with the Patent and Trademark Office.
Right.
And to the extent that he is not the true inventor.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because you basically have to say that these are the people who invented this.
Mm-hmm.
And he's lying. And the patent becomes, I would say, voidable. If she filed, she would have filed first. You know, she would have probably filed before going to Japan. I mean, the issue actually in Japan, so this is actually a real kind of case. They've combined things. I mean, it was actually a case of somebody giving a talk in Japan and calling, you know, somebody calling back and kind of scooping somebody else. And the issue about Japan is that our patent law says, one of the bars on somebody getting a patent is that there's a prior disclosure in the U.S. So going abroad and talking about it, and somebody from the U.S. being abroad, it basically says that that's not a bar, and it's a problem. But yeah,
so I'm just, I mean, I don't know about this, but when Sid told Bond and the other guy that this result or these results are not going to be published to science because they are not qualified or for his own interest.
Yeah, I mean, that was the conflict kind of like raising its ugly head, but it was also a lie. It's not truthful. I mean, in the U.S., you have a year after publication to file a patent application. So once you've published, then you can... I mean, the thing is that internationally, outside the U.S., to preserve rights, you have to... I mean, internationally, prior publication is at an absolute bar. So it's only in the U.S. that it's not. So... but he was lying, I mean, in a way. I mean, yes?
In addition to just... hiding the fact that he is Tin the real inventor, doesn't he also have a duty to show her paper and her presentation of prior art?
Yeah, that gets to the fraud on the office. So one of the things that happens with the prosecution of a patent is you have to be truthful, right? But you also have to then give a background on the patent in the patent application to what went before. So the patent examiner can go and look at the prior art, and you kind of help the patent examiner decide whether or not what you've actually taught with your patent is new, non-obvious to those skilled in the art, and patentable. And yes, you have an obligation to disclose that. But again, that gets into the foreign disclosure. But he's still lying, you know, that's the question. Ultimately, he's lying, and the patent, you know, if he got the patent, she could maybe sue in equity and take the patent, or she could just sue to invalidate the patent based on her prior work and her disclosure. But then she'd have to show that he was there, and she'd have to kind of like document the whole crazy path. So, yes?
And also, there's the fact that Dr. Indenture is not legally allowed to work on the human stem cells. I guess, potentially could say there's no moral violation besides the way you should follow the law. That's really the only reason, but that obviously is just not following the law.
So what should he have done?
I mean, he potentially, you know, was working with Mr. Bond, probably the graduate student, to find someone else who collaborated with him, so he was allowed to work with himself.
His boss told him to do something, though. It's
yeah, but I mean, he probably knew that he didn't have the correct credentials to do that. You think if he was, went through medical school and everything, that you know that.
Mm. Might have an obligation to blow the whistle and report his superior.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But if he doesn't do it, then nobody's violated the law. So how would he... What's he blowing the whistle on?
And being directed to do illegal research.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah, that's a tough one. Hmm. Yeah, I guess the institution would... Yeah. Yes?
I think that Dr. Seed is putting at risk the credibility and the career of many people, these both students, the attorney, and the credibility of the institution and the whole scientific society, and his own career also.
You'd like to think.
Well, yes, in a perfect world.
Right. Yeah, I mean, yeah, so all those things are kind of at risk here. Even the company, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the company is kind of spending the resources to kind of get the patent and all, and it's going to be not worth very much. He's kind of like looking at the short-term instead of the long-term consequences of this. But it also is somewhat predicated on whether or not she can make a case, right? And come after him. But anything else?
What about secrets?
Secrecy,
sharing of ideas.
Mm-hmm.
As I look here, when Dr. Seed went to Japan, he just said and listened, and immediately, you don't see that he's sharing information that already they have started these studies. Mm-hmm. So what he did, he was to listen to Irvine, presenting, and I think it was like kind of as Bernard Barber said that you have the knowledge, you don't want to share with others, or you just seek so as you can prove if you are correct, then you move, you go to publish, that is violation of norms.
Mm. And she was not being secretive, right? I mean, she was too probably young to be secretive. She probably should have, if she didn't take adequate precautions beforehand, she learned an expensive lesson. And again, I mean, it's like, I can't tell you how many scientists I've known when they were young, they had this kind of thing happen to them. Somebody scooped them, kind of like listened to them at a meeting. And I've had various people tell me that they learn who they can trust. They learn among those C's, competitors, colleagues, codependents, who they can trust and who they can't, who they can talk to and who they can't. It's really, it's just like any other field.
Okay, sorry. So I wanted to ask, we know plagiarism is taking somebody's ideas. Now you have somebody
without credit.
Yeah, without credit. You have somebody now, you have written your paper, for example.
Mm-hmm.
You go, you look at your paper and say, oh, this paper is not worthy to be published.
Mm-hmm.
Leave it. Meanwhile, you leave the whole content over there. You just take and edit, remove the name, and publish it. That's also plagiarism.
That's really bad plagiarism. That's, I mean, in some sense, taking somebody else's work and
pointing
it off
the
as your own.
Taking the whole content is also plagiarism.
Well, yes. I mean, taking the whole content is probably the worst embodiment of it. And there was a case some years ago of actually a fairly senior person who was reviewing for the NIH. So the review of proposals at the NIH, well, you can talk about proposal reviews in a couple of weeks, but it's, it's like a peer review of an application. And this person was a standing member of this committee, so he would see proposals coming up pretty regularly. And there was a proposal by one junior person that didn't get funded. And this person, about 3 or 4 years later, submitted it essentially that way, kind of intact, basically lifted this person's proposal for a study. They have made some tweaks to it and stuff and submitted it as his own. And that was problematic. They actually caught him and they threw the book at him. So he's one of the NIH's kind of like convictions for misconduct. And that's taking credit for somebody else's work. The funny thing about applications and proposals is that sometimes, and it gets a little bit dicey, is when you work on a proposal for research funding with someone else. Who owns what? Right? And it tends to be that the institution owns what you've produced. I mean, if you submit this, you submit a grant application to the NIH or to a funding agency, the institution technically owns that work product. And it'll have multiple names on it and multiple people who are associated with it. But who owns the exact words and all? And what happens if you want to use that application later? And who owns it? And could you be charged with misconduct because you weren't the sole author? If you took it and kind of like used it and massaged it and didn't cite, because in proposals, very rare, next to never do you ever see somebody kind of cite, you know, like thank people. I did that once in a proposal, thanking people who had read it beforehand. I've never seen that by others at all. But they don't necessarily kind of like cite other foregoing work, where it came from, especially their own work. And that's, I think, one problem, one area that needs to be worked out in science, because scientists, I mean, I feel ownership. If I've written stuff, I've contributed to a proposal, I feel ownership over that. And it turns out that the institution, when the grant comes in, the institution owns the grant, the PI is the lead investigator on it, and PI can kind of cut other people out. And it's like, it's the institution, if the institution is willing to support a PI in doing that, even though you put your intellectual horsepower into the application, it doesn't guarantee you funding. And I think it's an open question whether or not that can amount to plagiarism or theft if without compensation of some sort. But that'll be worked out. The other question, and what you're really raising, is the question of degree. And it's like, how much do you have to kind of copy? And does it have to be a verbatim copy, or is it the idea? And you know, these, I think, are somewhat unknown. I mean, the thing is, as a scientist, as a writer, I mean, if you're using somebody else's work and it's closely related to what you're doing, put it in quotes or cite it, or if you're changing, you're just kind of like, if you're describing in your own terms what somebody else has done, make sure you cite their, obviously cite their work, and try not to use their language. At least not too much of it. I mean, you know, a couple words here and there, a phrase maybe. But I would, even a phrase, especially a coin, you know, phrases get coined, they're, you know, has a catchy, with a catchy phrase that refers to something fixed, or something like a term of art that will, you know, that people will kind of acknowledge, recognize what it means. I mean, you really want to put that in quotes and cite the source, because you don't want to be ever charged with this. I mean, it's not good for your career to ever have somebody go off to the internet and use some of your text. I mean, there are search engines nowadays that, you know, you just kind of plug it in. In fact, Penn subscribes to one of these services. I can basically take somebody's paper here, submit it to this Penn office, I think it's graduate programs or something, and they will run it. And it's basically kind of like comparing it to the internet, looking for text. And if they find, you know, they'll actually report back on the document how much of it is duplicated from other sources. And that's bad for your careers. And it's all automated. And you know, the funny thing is, the internet has both made this kind of copying fairly easy to do, because you can kind of, I'm interested in this topic, and you go off and you can find lots of stuff talking about it. But then if you use that language, it's going to be found, because it's the same. You're all hitting up the same databases. But not that I'm ever looking for plagiarism. I only found it once. That was kind of by mistake. Actually, it wasn't my mistake. It was the student's mistake. Yeah. It's another story. I'll tell you next week. So, what else? Anything else? Actually, I think you've covered most of the issues. The only one I would add would be basically the teaching and mentorship issues and the abuse of power. I mean, one of the things you never want to do is give a student a commercial chore. And this is problematic in engineering and other disciplines, where somebody's doing something that could wind up being patented, or could be patented and licensed or something like that, where people then become, you know, their obligation to publish, and especially as a trainee, they have to publish quickly. They want to get their work out there, and if they're subjected to, you know, prior restraint on publication, rapid publication, for instance, if you do work for a pharmaceutical company, typically the terms are that you have a 6-month delay. Might be 30 days, might be 6 months, on publication. And if you're, you know, a graduate student doing really cutting-edge stuff and you want to get your dissertation out, that could actually block something. Right? And so you don't want to ever get into the situation where you're being held up or or heaven forbid, I know there are some stories of graduate students doing stuff that was then stamped top secret for various reasons. And it's like, your dissertation is top secret. It's like, you're I don't know how you do a defense of it under those circumstances. But there have been people who did stuff like that.
Once again, from the KC, as you can see, Dr. Seed was working with Bond, and this is in Indentura. Mm-hmm. But finally, he found that they did include them. That is, I think let's call that this, you can say, fraud or plagiarism. That they have worked together, mm-hmm. but you don't include them at the end. You just put your name. So what do you say, this fraud or plagiarism? Huh. Because they have shared the idea, and also, or is both?
It's a good question. What is it? Is it necessary to characterize? It is an abuse of power. I don't know, anybody have a thought about that? Did everybody hear the question? So the question is in the final publication of this manuscript without the two junior, the postdoc and the graduate student, is that fraud?
Yes, it is.
Is it, so the fraud would basically be, at least in the legal, I wish I had my lawyer here, but in the legal, we have another lawyer, in the legal sense, it's a misrepresentation on which people rely. So the misrepresentation is that I am the author, I'm the only author. And people rely on that in a way, saying, well, is the author and is the person we turn to, when really there were other people, not acknowledged people. So yeah, it is a form of fraud. I don't know that it would be punished as fraud.
But at the same time, I think it's plagiarism, because those people had the idea. As we see, they discussed the results.
Sure.
So they have their ideas. It
could also be plagiarism if he took Bond's words of his manuscript and used some of his manuscript without credit, which we don't have that fact, but he may have done that, since the paper is already written.
Well, sometimes it depends on the policy of the institution, what is considered authorship. Sometimes mm-hmm. it's only the person that wrote the article, whatever happened. Mm-hmm. So in this case, it would be okay. He is the only one that wrote it.
Maybe. He didn't do the work. And
sometimes it's hard to cut where do we stop putting names.
Right.
Like, I was working on a project where we were using blood. Do we cite the nurse that took the blood? Mm-hmm. Do we cite the person that recruited that person that the blood was taken? Mm-hmm. Where do we stop?
Yeah. Yeah. We'll talk about this.
But I think this issue is different from the case. As you can look here, about the three lines, bottom three lines, find that they discussed the results together. And I think that's why the one who made this case made it papadri that Dr. C did include them or acknowledge them.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, typically, I think you would acknowledge the work of others who were involved. I mean, I think, but we'll talk about authorship in a couple of weeks, but you're right, it is kind of like what are individuals' practices regarding, for instance, inclusion of research assistants and stuff like that who may have put hands on data. And I think an acknowledgement across many fields, an acknowledgement at least, is pretty common. So cutting them out of that is bad. Whether or not they, but it's also, if you have as a rule, if you have a postdoc working on your projects, not putting the postdoc, not letting the postdoc publish your paper.
That's the whole purpose of the postdoc, right?
Right, they have to publish papers because they're going off to get a job. And they need publications. So, I mean, if nothing else, it's an abuse of power and it's kind of a bad mentorship model. Yeah.
It also seems like he's using NIH funds and he's getting the postdocs to use those funds to do the research, but really this is more benefiting the private firm. So is that
totally a problem?
Because, I mean,
no, it's not a problem.
Isn't it usually like separate, there's like delineations? I mean, I guess it depends on how you read this, but it seems like the firm could be doing something else, but by calling up people who aren't even approved to be doing this type of thing, he's like...
Well, putting tend on there is a problem. But the idea that you're going to use federal dollars to do research that then yields patents that are then licensed to a company is purely federal policy. That's what we want. So we can talk about it in 2 weeks when we talk about conflicts of interest, especially because there's been a recent change in the NIH policy that raises this issue. But, you know, 1980 Bayh-Dole Act basically embodies this idea. It says, we give you, the institution, money. You go off, you do good work, you patent those discoveries, and then you license them. And when you license them, you want to create small companies. There's a preference for small US-based companies for licensing. And when you start getting royalties, you're supposed to return the royalties to the investigators. And now we have conflict rules which say, well, if you're an investigator and you're getting money, you can't do a clinical trial. Right? So you've taken the expert who's kind of like made the basic discoveries, who now is kind of like prohibited because the intellectual property regime that we've imposed creates this untenable conflict of interest that we don't know how to handle, and we've let that get back and basically then restrict what it is the researcher can do. And I've actually, on the conflicts committee, we've heard of cases of researchers who have run into this too many times and they've stopped submitting their disclosures, which is kind of comical and it's sad. But we'll talk about that in 2 weeks. Any other answer here?
Yeah, I was just going to go off of that. Could he actually put his name, if he put his name on this paper, Dr. Indenture, would just invalidate the whole paper, even though, well, not the paper, but the patent, maybe? I don't know.
Well, if he put his name on it, it would give the feds a link to the fact that the stem cells were used, the cells were used, I mean, the research was done with federal dollars. Technically, if he was funded by the feds, he's supposed to acknowledge federal funding for that, not only on the patent paper, but as on the patent as well. And not to do that, we don't actually know if everybody does it on the patent side. But if he did do it, that would allow the feds to trace the money pretty readily, and he'd be up a creek early in his career. This only happened once. There was under the Bush policy back in like 10 years ago, there was one guy, I think at GW, I don't know if anybody remembers this, but a guy who was had federal dollars in his lab, and when the Bush came out with his policy about kind of like segregating stem cells, certain lines could be used and others couldn't be used with federal dollars, this guy had not done the adequate segregation in his lab of the two pots of money in the cells, and he wound up getting punished. I forget exactly what happened to him. If anybody's interested, we could look into it. But he was made an example of. But. Yeah.
So, yeah, just another question. What's going to be the penalty of having this problem? Will it be only said or even Bond and other people working with him, if they knew about it or if they didn't know about it, will they be involved in the penalty with Brian?
I don't know. That's a tough one. I never thought about that aspect of this. I mean, in some sense, I mean, the patent could be avoidable. I mean, if Tend found out about the patent application, she could go after it. She could sue. I mean, her institution might sue his institution. The postdoc, if he was discovered, I'm not sure how they could be discovered. I mean, if somebody kind of like put the story together and showed that he was doing this work, then, he obviously was keeping notebooks. The record exists. It would be pretty bad. I think it might be illegal for Seed to destroy the records of that, but it would be a traceable record that this guy did this work that he was prohibited by law from working on, and the punishment that would be against the institution. I would hope that he wouldn't go to jail for this, but the institution would lose money. At least they'd have to pay fines, so maybe return the grants and stuff like that.
But they think that if they were to punish each individual person, I think he only Bond could survive. As you can see, I have Sid who has stolen, mm-hmm. and is coming to his Pharaoh, to Indenture, who by law was not allowed to work on human same series, was not allowed by the law. So that was also a mistake of Indenture. But the big mistake here, Bond is working with Dr. Sid, who is coming and telling them like his own idea. Don't tell them the original way. So I can see a Bond was innocent, but these two, everybody had the problem.
Right. And Bond is innocent, but he's kind of going to be the least powerful individual in the mix. And there have been cases that we're going to talk about whistleblowing next week, but there was the cases where students have blown the whistle on their mentors, and the students invariably take it in the teeth. And you know, they're most vulnerable in the entire system. And it's not clear that, you know, it's pretty clear that, you know, other faculty, at least in some of these cases, haven't stepped up to kind of save these students. And it's ludicrous that they wouldn't, but it happens. Okay, I think we that's one. Any other issues? So that's ethics. Next week is misconduct, so now we'll talk really kind of like the machinations of misconduct and how it works and what we know about it. All right. Any final observations, questions? No? Okay, thanks. Have a good week.